Good morning. The first reading today is from Judges 6, starting at verse 11. The angel of the Lord came and sat down under the oak in Ophrah that belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in a winepress to keep it from the Midianites. When the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, he said, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." "Pardon me, my lord," Gideon replied, "but if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are all his wonders that our ancestors told us about when they said, 'Did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt?' But now the Lord has abandoned us and given us into the hand of Midian." The Lord turned to him and said, "Go in the strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you?" "Pardon me, my lord," Gideon replied, "but how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my family." The Lord answered, "I will be with you, and you will strike down all the Midianites, leaving none alive." Gideon replied, "If now I have found favor in your eyes, give me a sign that it is really you talking to me. Please do not go away until I come back and bring my offering and set it before you." And the Lord said, "I will wait until you return." Gideon went inside, prepared a young goat, and from an ephah of flour he made bread without yeast. Putting the meat in a basket and its broth in a pot, he brought them out and offered them to him under the oak. The angel of God said to him, "Take the meat and the unleavened bread, place them on this rock, and pour out the broth." And Gideon did so. Then the angel of the Lord touched the meat and the unleavened bread with the tip of the staff that was in his hand. Fire flared from the rock, consuming the meat and the bread, and the angel of the Lord disappeared. When Gideon realized that it was the angel of the Lord, he exclaimed, "Alas, sovereign Lord, I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face." But the Lord said to him, "Peace, do not be afraid, you are not going to die." So Gideon built an altar to the Lord there and called it, "The Lord is Peace." To this day it stands in Ophrah of the Abiezrites. The same night the Lord said to him, "Take the second bull from your father's herd, the one 7 years old. Tear down your father's altar to Baal and cut down the Asherah pole beside it. Then build a proper kind of altar to the Lord your God on top of this height. Using the wood of the Asherah pole that you cut down, offer the second bull as a burnt offering." So Gideon took 10 of his servants and did as the Lord told him. But because he was afraid of his family and the townspeople, he did it at night rather than in the daytime. In the morning, when the people of the town got up, there was Baal's altar, demolished, with the Asherah pole beside it cut down, and the second bull sacrificed on the newly built altar. They asked each other, "Who did this?" When they carefully investigated, they were told, "Gideon, son of Joash, did it." The people of the town demanded of Joash, "Bring out your son, he must die because he has broken down Baal's altar and cut down the Asherah pole beside it." But Joash replied to the hostile crowd around him, "Are you going to plead Baal's cause? Are you trying to save him? Whoever fights for him shall be put to death by morning. If Baal really is a god, he can defend himself when someone breaks down his altar." So because Gideon broke down Baal's altar, they gave him the name Jerubbaal that day, saying, "Let Baal contend with him." And the second reading is from Hebrews 13, starting at verse 1. Keep on loving one another as brothers and sisters. Do not forget to show hospitality to strangers, for by doing so, some people have shown hospitality to angels without knowing it. Continue to remember those in prison as if you were together with them in prison, and those who are mistreated as if you yourselves were suffering.
Good morning, my name's Stephen, one of the pastors here. When I was about 18, I went to visit a friend's church at night, and the singing at that church was being led by a young guy around the same age as me, and in that church he was called the worship leader. And he was a good singer, this guy, and he was really into it. He was raising his hands and closing his eyes and everything. And then after the service, I was driving down the road to head to Macca's, when suddenly this car comes flying up alongside me, doing like 100 in a 60 zone, and the window comes down, and out leans some guy who yells at the top of his voice, "F you," at me. Now, I was a bit shocked, but when I turned and saw who it was who was yelling at me, the worship leader, I was even more shocked. I mean, if Les does that to you on the way home, I think you'd be shocked as well. It's like that guy thought that you leave worshiping God behind at the entrance to the church. But what we see today, and what we're going to see over the next 5 weeks, actually, is that it's almost like the opposite. Worshiping God is something that you take up with you as you leave the church. It's something you take with you everywhere. Worship that God accepts is all about love shaped by Jesus. We've been looking at the book of Hebrews for something like 3 months straight now. It's quite a while. And what we've seen over these 3 months is that Jesus worships God perfectly. He's the perfect high priest we've seen, who offers himself as the perfect sacrifice. He does it in perfect obedience. And in his perfect worship, he makes us perfect before God. And so Jesus, he enables us to worship God properly, and he gives us the shape of what that worship should look like. Look at the last two verses of last week's passage. Have this passage open in front of you, but go for now to Hebrews chapter 12, verse 28. If you don't have a Bible, feel free to jump up and grab one from the back or grab out your phone. But have a look at Hebrews chapter 12, verse 28. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us be thankful and so worship God acceptably with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. And today we start to see the shape that this worship should take. And it's not really about songs and singing. Worship God accepts is all about love shaped by Jesus. And today we see that it's a love that perseveres, it's a love that risks, it's a love that suffers. And so first of all, acceptable worship of God looks like a love that perseveres. It perseveres keeping on loving one another as family. Look at again at chapter 13, verse 1 with me. So how do we worship God acceptably? First of all, verse 1. Keep on loving one another as brothers and sisters. Now, across Hebrews, we've seen what God's love has driven him to do for us in Jesus. Way back in Hebrews chapter 2, we read that Jesus took on flesh and blood and shared in our humanity to help us. He suffered and died to free us from death and to bring many sons and daughters to glory. And so we read, we're of the same family as Jesus. He's not ashamed, we read back in chapter 2, he's not ashamed to call us brothers and sisters. But think about that. The Lord of the universe is not ashamed to call himself your brother. Think about the person here, perhaps, that you find hardest to love, the one you're a little bit ashamed of. Jesus is not ashamed to call that person his brother or sister. And now in chapter 13, the one who's not ashamed to call us family, he now calls us to love each other as family, when it's easy, but also when it's hard. In other words, our love for each other here, it's not optional and it can't be superficial. Now, family's a hard work. If you go out there and ask people, what's the meaning of life? Probably a fairly common answer that you'll get from people is family. Like, life's all about family. That's its meaning. But then if you observe how people actually live, you might doubt what they're saying. We often work in a way that actually isn't very helpful to our families. And then even when we're together as a family, we're often apart in different rooms, on different devices. And once we move out of home, often brothers and sisters don't see each other that much. And then sometimes when they do, things are really strained in families. And what I'm saying is that family, we know family really should be a place of love. But to successfully be a place of healthy brotherly and sisterly love, that takes hard work, and it keeps on taking hard work. We know that about earthly families. But do we know that about our family here? Is that how we approach Jesus' family here? Or do we approach things as if we have the option of loving each other? As if it's okay for our love to just be superficial? Because if we do, that's not worship that's acceptable to God. The truth is, it's actually very hard to keep on loving one another as family. And I don't think our danger is that love will completely disappear. I think our danger here is that our love will lose its depth and become shallow. And maybe this has even been your experience here. Are we present here but not engaged? Friendly but not truly known? Around but not actually committed to each other? Because if that's who we are, then our love has lost its depth. And that's not loving each other like family. And it's unacceptable to God. Because, you know, you can do all those things while catching a bus into the city. You can be present but not engaged. Friendly but not known. And around but not committed. And you can do all of that on a bus. And you're never going to get off on Grenfell Street and think, I just love my bus family. It doesn't go that way. Now, some of the signs that could point to our love here being superficial are things like if we don't show up for each other, if our attendance in our community group or here on a Sunday is irregular. Another sign is if our community groups or our conversations here lack any depth or honesty or vulnerability. Another sign that this could be us is if we're quite happy to have relational drift or even to tolerate tension between us and leave it unresolved. So let me ask you to be honest just with yourself for a second. Is this your experience? And so often this is our experience these days, and it's our experience in all sorts of places. We have this moment often in group settings where we think to ourselves, I'm turning up, but I'm not experiencing real connection. And then what do we think next? Well, generally next what we do is we blame someone or something for that experience. We blame the other people there. They're the problem. Or we blame the way that things are set up there. Or we blame ourselves for our own social inadequacies. But that never really helps anything if we just sort of stop there blaming but defeated. Never helps anything if we don't do something about it. In our heads, we're often saying to ourselves, but we're too busy. But the truth is, we're still making time for certain things. So the real question is, why isn't my Christian family making that list? The real barrier is not simply time. The real barrier is things like our emotional energy and our expectations. We assume that deep relationships will cost me too much. Deep relationships will cost me more emotional energy than I have banked. And so we settle for low-cost, superficial connection. But listen again to this command, because it doesn't point us to attribute blame. And it doesn't point us to be realists and store up what we need in the bank first before we get out there and spend it. In fact, notice it doesn't point us anywhere. It commands. It commands us. Keep on loving one another as brothers and sisters. Do you know the good thing about a bare command like this from God? It actually takes away the emotional, cognitive burden that's so often there. We don't have to weigh up whether we can afford to do it or not. We only have to weigh up whether we can trust God enough to obey him or not. If you can trust God, then you can obey. And this is one of those counterintuitive things. God knows best. And he knows that keeping on loving one another as brothers and sisters is exactly what we need and is actually what in the end will put fuel in our tank when we do it. We need to trust God in this. But let me give you just a few simple, very doable kind of ways that you can step into this if you're feeling sort of stuck or a bit paralyzed. So first things first, reprioritize presence before depth. Now, I know this sounds the opposite to some of the things that I've just been saying. You know, I've said being present doesn't equal being engaged and going deep. And that's true, but being present consistently over time, it generally does lead to depth. Showing up consistently for people to church and to your community group and in their lives, that does lead in time, generally, to love deepening. We shouldn't wait, you know, until we feel like it. There's some of us that pretty much never feel like it beforehand, aren't there? Some of us never feel like we have the emotional reserves. But what happens when you still show up for others in those times? Well, generally, a lot of the time what happens is afterwards you'll leave thankful that you showed up. And more than that, you'll actually leave topped up with the love of Jesus and the love of his people. So that's the first practical step. Think about what you're not showing up to and reprioritize presence over depth. The next practical step, though, is lower the bar for honesty. When you are present, when you do show up, try to share at least one real sentence with someone during that time. You know, something like, I'm actually not going that great this week. Or something like, this week's actually been much better than last week. Thank you for praying for me. Keep the bar low, but at the same time, keep honesty there every single time that you show up for each other. And a third practical step that we can take is to do that shift from consuming to contributing, to come asking, who can I show love to today? When we come asking, what can I get from this? What ends up happening is that we disengage from it. We become a passenger in it. But when we come asking, who can I love in this? We're more observant. We're looking. We're engaged. And it's exactly how family is supposed to work. Everyone looking out for each other and not for themselves. So every time you show up somewhere, pray on the way, Lord, who do you want me to show love to today? The truth is, if we're not going to drift into this kind of love. You don't drift into deep love like this. You decide into it one small, costly step at a time. And that's exactly the kind of worship that God accepts from us. And persevering in keeping on loving each other as family, it's challenging. But what we come to next in this passage is even more challenging. Next, we see that acceptable worship of God looks like a love that risks. Looks like a love that risks welcoming the stranger. Look at chapter 13, verse 2. Verse 2, do not forget to show hospitality to strangers. In the original language in the Greek, the first command was literally the Philadelphia continue. And this command is the Philoxenus, don't forget. And so we have brotherly love in the first command. This is strangerly love, if you like. Both are about love. That's what the philos means, the word means there. But the first one's about love of those who are already in our circle. And the second one is about love of those not yet known to us. Now, it's likely that in their context, receiving this letter, that this is talking about unknown Christians. It's talking about newcomers to their gatherings and probably traveling believers as well. Either those who've lost property and faced persecution and are fleeing that, but also traveling missionaries and teachers who played such an important role in the early church. But the shape of this worship, this love, is opening ourselves and our lives and our homes to those not in our circle. And love like this is risky. And I don't mean it's risky because you might accidentally invite an axe murderer over for lunch or something like that. I suppose that's theoretically possible. Although our passage says you might accidentally invite an angel over for lunch. And the point of this passage is not, you know, that loving strangers is like playing Russian roulette between axe murderers and angels and you just never quite know what you're going to get. The point is that God so often works by bringing amazing blessings through strangers. Let's be honest, the risk is small in doing this. The risk is essentially that we might not be repaid, that we might give without ever getting. But even though the risk is small, nonetheless, it takes our time and it takes even more of our emotional energy and it could be awkward. You know, I could be feeling overwhelmed already from the idea just of loving people I already know who are already here like family. And so why would I show hospitality to a stranger? Well, because this is how God so often brings amazing blessings to his people. And because Jesus is our ultimate example of someone who opens his life and welcomes in strangers. He goes to the cross to make strangers family, brothers, sisters. That's what our Lord does. And he leads us to worship and he enables us to worship by doing the same. So how are we going at this? Are we warm here at church, but closed in our homes? You know, a good way to think about this is, when was the last time you opened up your home to someone? When was the last time you had someone around? But even more challenging is, when was the last time you opened your home to someone outside of the circle of people that you already know? You know, if you bring that to mind, when was it? This is confronting. It's costly. But again, this is what we're commanded to do as we live for this unshakable kingdom to come. But I think our danger is that we'll be just like the rest of the world around us, all of those who live around us. I mean, if you think about how do most Australians approach hospitality these days? Well, so many of us have got homes that are a private sanctuary. That's the way we live these days, rather than a place of welcome. And, you know, there are subcultures around that do open up their homes to friends, but usually it's friends still who are like them, friends who come from the same cultural background as them. But do you see the way that Jesus is leading us to worship God here? We're commanded to love the other, the stranger. To open our lives and homes to people not like us, not from our group of friends, maybe not from our culture or our language background. And the barrier to this is not that we can't. It's that it's inconvenient. We can't control how it will go, how long it will take, and how it will all pan out in the end. But you know, it's never a waste of time if it's done for God. It's worship. And it's entirely like our God that the way that He'll have it pan out is that we are blessed through those strangers. It really is. That's the point of the weird kind of angel bit in that passage. So again, let me give you just a few simple, very doable ways that you can start to step into this if you're feeling stuck. So first things first, start simple and regular. You know, aim for just one invitation a month. Get it into your calendar, both the event, but also the reminder to organize the next event. And start simple, keep it simple. Start simple by starting with people at church. You know, the truth is there are too many of us here to all be in the same circle, to all know each other really well. We are actually strangers to each other, some of us. So reach out to those that God places on your heart who aren't in your circle. Start simple and regular. Another practical step is to make it normal, not impressive. The idea is not to impress, it's to include. And in fact, I'd almost go as far as to say is that if you do impress, that's a fail. Just make it a simple meal, you know, like sausages on a barbecue or even takeaway. I remember someone here a number of years ago, she told me that she'd always been put off hospitality because she wasn't a very good cook. But then she realized that that's actually not what hospitality is about at all. And so she started having people around and just serving up toasted sandwiches for lunch. Now, to me, that's impressive because it's real. And a messy house is fine too. Even scruffy, disobedient children are totally fine because that's real. Make it normal, not impressive. And a final step is to build it into your existing life. And we tell ourselves, oh, we've got to find a new night. How are we going to do that to start being hospitable? But don't try to add in a new night. Add in a person to what you're already doing. Invite someone to a meal that you're already going to be eating anyway, or to an activity that you're already going to be doing. You know, like invite them to walk the dog with you, or to pretend to watch your kid's netball game alongside you, or just to have lunch at TTP after church. Or to come to dinner between 7 and 8:30 while the kids are at youth. Gives a great kind of short time slot. We think, oh, well, I'll start hospitality once I manage to get life calm. But it doesn't have to be like that. It can start just as you let people into your real life. But do remember, this is about showing love to strangers, to people outside the circle of friends that we already have. And that kind of love, it's hard. It's very hard. It's costly. But we're about to see here that it gets even harder. So acceptable worship of God, it looks like a love that perseveres loving one another as family. It looks like a love that risks loving and welcoming even strangers. And finally, we see today that it looks like a love that suffers. It suffers standing with the persecuted as if it were you. Look at chapter 13, verse 3. Continue to remember those in prison as if you were together with them in prison, and those who are mistreated as if you yourselves were suffering. Now, in their context, persecution for being a Christian was pretty severe. And the command here is not to keep your head down and keep away. It's to stand with those being persecuted and to identify with them. It's incredibly powerful when this happens. It's quite unsettling to people when their persecution doesn't send other people running like they thought it should. And when that persecution actually pulls people in, pulls them together, it says to them, they can't touch you. Not really. They can't reach the hope of heaven that you're living for. They can't even get close to that. But even more important than that, when we stand with those persecuted, God says to us, He accepts that act of love as worship. So how do you go with this? When someone's mocked at work or school or uni for being a Christian, do you stand with them to be mocked? Or do you stand at a safe distance? People aren't imprisoned in this country for their faith. But the truth is that people right here among us are mistreated for following Jesus. People here. Some of us here almost daily face family tension for following Jesus. Some are married to an unbeliever. Some have unbelieving parents. Some of us experience pressure at work or exclusion at school. Some of us here are quietly carrying the cost of following Jesus, and many of us haven't even noticed. We can't afford to stay at a distance. Love means we need to stand with those who are suffering. And it should start here. It must start here. But it's the same as in your school or uni or work. It's an act of worship when you stand with those, with other Christians, when they're mistreated. And if there are ways that we can stand with believers from around the world when they're mistreated, then we should. So let me ask you, when you see people ridiculed for following Jesus, even though you might feel like stepping away, do you choose to move toward them and out yourself as a follower of Jesus alongside them? Again, let me give you just a few simple, quick, doable ways that we can step into this in stepping alongside each other in suffering. So first things first, don't assume people are finding it easy to follow Jesus. Don't assume they're finding it easy in their workplaces and families. Instead, ask people, maybe ask someone you think might be finding it hard, what it's costing them to follow Jesus. And second, when you find out it is costing them, move toward them, not away. In all suffering, love causes us to move towards those who are suffering. Love means being present in their discomfort and in the discomfort that it causes us. Not trying to fix things, but just standing with people through suffering. And it's the same with those suffering persecution. And of course, be prepared that some of us here have suffered an awful lot in the countries we've come from and know people who are still suffering in those countries often as well. And then third and finally, another practical step is to pray immediately. You know, when someone tells you that they're suffering, don't wait till later, but right then and there, pray with them. Doesn't matter if it feels a bit awkward, it's a very small way that we can stand with people and then follow up later on. Because love doesn't stay at a distance, it steps into their pain. So today we've started to see the kind of worship that God accepts. And it's not the worship that we pick up when the band picks up their instruments. It's the kind of worship, can you see, that we take with us everywhere. And it's a worship that's in the shape of love. But the idea that we could be without this kind of love, that is unacceptable to God. Because we're not like family, you realize. We are family. We are the family Jesus loves, the strangers that he has welcomed in. We are the brothers and sisters that he stood with and bled for. We're the family, Jesus' family, that he leads to worship God with a love that is shaped by him. So if there's no space for this love in your life, or if there's no space for this love in the life of our church family, something's got to change in our lives. And it's got to change now. So who's one person this week that you can show up for and love like family? Or you can make space for and welcome in, even if they're a stranger. Or stand with and suffer alongside. Because that's acceptable worship. That's what it looks like. Let me pray. Father, we thank you so much for Jesus, that his obedience was perfect. His worship was perfect. His sacrifice was perfect. Lord, that he has done all that is needed to make us perfect before you. It blows our minds, the love that he has shown to bring us and make us his family, your children, destined for glory. But Lord, help us to trust him and to obey him when he commands from us a kind of worship that we find so hard. Lord, help us not to be superficial in our love for each other, but deep. Lord, help our love to extend even to strangers to us, and especially, Lord, to those who are suffering for you. Lord, help us to stand alongside them. We need your help in this, and we ask for it in Jesus' name. Amen.